Okay, I'm Gus Sauter from Vanguard, and Joe was close. We have about $1.7 trillion under management in around the world, about $1.6 trillion in U.S. mutual funds. So I'm going to discuss I'll be discussing what the auditors found. Norma just talked about what the auditors did. The first question we asked in this section was the evaluation of significant estimates and judgments. And here, 79%, an overwhelming supermajority of respondents believe that the auditor should discuss significant estimates and judgments made by the management. I personally strongly agree with this. I would liken this to the difference between a physicist and a statistician. A physicist is very hard mathematics, believe in single point estimates, and I would distinguish that from a statistician who believes there's a distribution of outcomes. And when we look at financial statements, we get a single point estimate. We get the physicist's view of what the world looks like. Unfortunately, we recognize that many of these numbers have a broad band of around them, that they are, in fact, estimates. And so I believe that we need information that a statistician would look at here. And so including this in an audit report, the fact that there are estimates and judgments and what those estimates and judgments are is very important. I would note that there is a comment here that is the job of management. I don't disagree that that's the job of management. It's perhaps not fair to debate somebody who's not here, but I do find I'm more successful in debates that way. But I do believe that the financial statements and the audit report are created for the benefit of investors, not for management. They're really not. They're useful statements for management, certainly to help them better manage the company. But ultimately, they are created for investors, and this is, I think, very valuable information that we would love to have. Second question we asked in this section was about evaluation of accounting policies and practices. And again, a large majority of investors or of the respondents indicated that they believe the auditor should discuss the quality of the accounting policies and the practices, not just the acceptability. So we know there are many ways to create financial statements within the auspices of GAAP accounting, but some of them may better reflect what's really going on in the company than others. And so it's important for the accounting report, the audit report, to indicate how well the types of policies chosen by management to represent the company really do represent the financials of the company, and how consistently those were applied. Another, important question is the sensitivity analysis performed by the audit engagement team. So 65%, another, again, there was a strong agreement throughout this entire section of questions. 65% would like the auditor to include the results of the sensitivity analysis in significant areas of judgment. This ties into one of the questions that Norman was talking about the risk of the audit. What parts of the audit represent greater risk than others? What can we learn from doing sensitivity analysis? And I think actually there's a very good example with the global financial crisis transparency actually can lead to higher valuations of stocks rather than lower. That this doesn't represent risk to management or to the company. That it actually can represent value to management and certainly value to investors. And I would just point to the stress tests that were done on the banks. Those stress tests came out, I believe, in April of 2009. The market bottomed in March of 2009. And it largely bottomed with the knowledge that the stress tests were going quite well and would be quite positive. So, in fact, stress tests, in the case of the banking system, really proved to be a very positive thing. And valuations started to rise from there. So removing uncertainty is a very important principle with investing. Next question was disclose unusual transactions and restatements and other significant changes. And yet again, 67% believe that the auditor should disclose unusual transactions, restatements, and significant changes. The Kahn comment says that management should do all of this, and much of this should be done by management. But I think it's important. The way I think of the auditor's report is, to me, it's an executive summary or an abstract. And to me, it should be giving us a little bit of a roadmap as investors as to what we should be focusing on. What are key areas that we should know about and look for inside the financials? So this would be important information to know that there was something unusual, something to not ignore, something to track down. And then I believe the final question here is disclose the key issues discussed in the summary audit memorandum. And here, 54% believe that the auditor should discuss key issues in the summary audit memorandum, and 18% did disagree. If I were to rank all of the things that we surveyed here, quite honestly, giving you my candid opinion, I pretty much agree with the top of the comment here, only if issues were not resolved. So, yes, it'd be important if there are issues that are not resolved, but discussing, in my personal view and that of Vanguard, to discuss issues that were resolved and that the auditor felt comfortable with would be of less importance to me. I recognize that we can't, that in fact, if we put everything into an audit report that we're surveying here, the audit report would be as thick as a prospectus. And we know that very few investors read a prospectus, which is the advantage of a summary prospectus. So really observing the principle of parsimony, I think this one to me falls down a little bit lower on my list of priorities. But here is a summary of all of the questions in this particular section. And you can see large agreement in most of these questions, very, very strong agreement, most significant being the assessment of the issuer's estimates and judgments. Again, representing Vanguard's views and my personal views, I would say that is the most important thing to me that should be included in an auditor's report. The second question was discussion of unusual transactions and restatements. And to me, that if I were ranking these myself, that would be third for me. So very important, again, assessment of quality of issuers' accounting policies and practices, strong agreement there. My second favorite would be the next one, the discussion of sensitivity analyses, as I mentioned before, doing stress tests. And then finally, on the positive side, the discussion of key issues included in the summary audit memorandum. But there were a couple of questions that I did not cover here that were in the survey where really the respondents were somewhat ambivalent toward. The first one was the disclosure of all audit adjustments discussed with management, and there it was 50-50, whether or not people favored that or opposed it. And similarly, grading the issuer's aggressiveness or conservatism in creating the financial statements on a 1-to-point scale, 1-to-10-point scale, and again, this was a 50-50 toss-up. So that's it for this next section, and I will turn to Ann to present the final section.
Good morning, everyone. Given that we're sort of running out of time, I'm going to blow through my slides a bit. I was charged with, oh no, this is why my husband never gives me the remote control. Can I touch a button to get rid of the view? Sorry. I don't want to touch anything now.
You gonna do it?
I won't touch it. Well, let me start. My task is to summarize the survey responses relative to the form of the audit report. Okay, let me just get there really quick. Apologies, everyone. is going to take up. We have a long slide thing here, don't we? Oh, darn it. Okay. I'm just going to roll through it. I think everyone's got it. It's going to be up on the website. First of all, in terms of the form of the report, the survey did find that there was strong support for reforms to the report. First, two-thirds of the respondents that had an opinion suggested and strongly supported expanding the assurance language in the current auditor's report to expressly state that that assurance, in terms of whether there's a possible risk, a material risk to the financial statements as to a misstatement, address whether that's caused by an error or fraud. And I know there's been a lot of debate over the years about what's the auditor's role in terms of detecting fraud, and one of the comments on the slide sort of, I think, says it all, which is that auditors should state that they at least looked for material fraud. Second issue was regarding the auditor partner's signature, and a slightly less than 60% of the respondents that had an opinion on that issue believe that the audit engagement partner should sign the report. In terms of how should this additional information be presented to investors, I think somewhere north of 70% of the respondents that had an opinion on that believe that there should be a separate auditor discussion and analysis section. So there should not be an expansion of the current report, but instead an additional report that would be provided in the 10K. Regarding whether there should be disclosure in that report of information provided to the audit committees, again, somewhere north of 70% of those that had an opinion on that issue believed that indeed the report should include at least some narrative summary of issues that have been communicated by the audit firm to the audit committee. Two issues that I'm not going to talk about, but where we found there was sort of less support, first and foremost, was this issue of whether that binary nature, that pass-fail nature of the current report should be changed to be more gradated, whether there should be the allowance for C reports or different grades in the middle. And there actually was a real split within the respondents. So I don't think we didn't find strong support for changing the current kind of pass-fail model of the existing report. And there was also, I think, more opposition, although still support for the concept of greater disclosure about the roles of management versus the auditor in terms of identifying, detecting, and preventing fraud. So I think the key takeaways from the survey are that status quo is no longer appropriate. It's real strong support within the respondents that there should be changes and expansion of the information provided to investors. And I think our view stepping back is that this is the role of the auditor. I know there's a lot of questions about what's the auditor's role here in terms of costs and benefits, and perhaps we'll talk about that more in the Q&A section. But our belief is that what the survey respondents said they wanted is work that the audit firms are already doing. The question here and the issue is providing more information to investors so that they can do a better job analyzing the quality of the reported financials, understanding where the risks may be with those financial statements, and helping them make a better investment decision. So if I identified the top four issues that came out of the survey, there's just broad support for greater disclosure on the auditor's assessment of management's estimates and judgments and the process that the auditor used to reach that assessment. Second, areas of high risk to the financial statements, and our concern here isn't operational risk. It's concern that the financials may be materially problematic. Third, greater disclosure about unusual transactions, restatements, and other really significant changes. And finally, the quality of the issuer's accounting practices and policies. I think in conclusion, regarding next steps, and I'm only speaking for Joe, Gus, and Norm, Ann and Brandon, we weren't able to talk to you before this, so I don't want to put words in your mouth, but we would very much like to urge the board to methodically but aggressively address this issue and resolve this issue. It's been debated now for 40-plus years. It's under debate around the globe. The fact is that our markets are known for having the highest standards in terms of transparency and quality of information to investors, and we believe there's an opportunity and an important role for the U.S. to lead this discussion of how these reports should be changed. Thank you.
Well, Joe, Norman, and Gus, and Ann, thank you very much. That was clearly showed a terrific amount of work and effort. I will save my questions to the last, preserve myself 5 minutes, if I may, and open it up to Chairman Shapiro or Chairman Doty for any words that they like, and then we'll just open it up for questions.
Well, let me just say I'm anxious to hear the discussion, but I actually thought this was just a first-rate presentation, and I agree with Steve. Clearly an enormous amount of work and thought went into it, and I think it will inform the discussion incredibly well. So I really thank you so much for it.
Joe, first a technical point, and it's important, I think, for the board. I think you all adjusted your responses to focus on the people in these organizations who are actually investing the money and to wait away from the individuals who might be giving multiple responses but were involved in other functions. Is that true?
Let's see here.
So the preferences, the point being the preferences that you're summarizing here for us are the ones of the investor decision makers.
Well, you can see it. Maybe you can't see it. Bottom left.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. As Jim said, and I was able to give Jim an advanced look at this yesterday. As we were thinking about this a little bit deeper, although we contacted only investor organizations, once the questionnaire got there, we had no control over who filled it out. And so we had CFOs, we had controllers, we had board members, we had audit committee members, and not that their opinions don't matter. But I thought it might be interesting to see if only those who are in an investment function, who actually are buying and selling, would evaluate these things differently. And the answer, Jim, is yes, very much so. On every single question, how often do you find that? Okay. Every single question, the investors evaluated the need for change higher than did the overall respondent. So what I've done here is I've taken the issue, you know, summarized it in, you know, just a couple of words on the far left column, and then the overall mean in the next column, that's the all respondents, and then the investor only, and then the difference. And what you see, Jim, is that on some things, it's a pretty big difference. Now, you might say, oh, 0.37, 0.36, 0.34 is not that big a difference. It's a 5-point scale. And so some of these differences are pretty noticeable. And so I think two takeaways, again, are that in general, investors want change more than the overall population. And if you look at, you know, the ones that I have in bold are the ones where there was a big change and there seemed to be meaningful support. I define meaningful support as a mean of 3.5 or higher. So materiality disclosure, risk disclosure. Look at that risk disclosure number, 4.32. That's on a 5-point scale. And that's a very, very high number. Unusual transactions, 4.14, significant estimates and judgments, sensitivity analyses, quality of accounting policies and practices. The numbers were high when we had the overall respondents. When you limit it, Jim, just to investment professionals, the numbers even go higher.
And to go back to Ann's recommendation to the board, which I take it is the recommendation of the whole committee, which is that we address it methodically but high priority right away. And I may have missed this in Gus's presentation, but how do you all rank the priorities of the matters you'd like to see discussed in light of what you just put up? Where, for example, do sensitivity analyses, discussion of what the auditor did, and what they performed by way of tests, where does that rate in relationship to some of the other issues, and then some kind of overall statement about where the auditor looked for misapplication, fraud,
The four items that Ann finished with, Jim, that last slide, those were the four items on the questionnaire that had the greatest support, both from investors and from all respondents. And we assessed greatest support in two ways. The highest percentage of people who said they wanted this information either agreed or strongly agreed that additional information in those areas would be helpful, as well as the biggest difference between those who supported that information and those who didn't think it would be helpful. So we basically took those who agreed or strongly agreed, compared it to those who disagreed and strongly disagreed, and looked for magnitude of difference.
I don't want this to appear rehearsed. You said we talked. This is not a rehearsal.
Yeah, no, this isn't rehearsed.
But I do think I take away from what you have said, from what you've all said, that the interest in the investor group is to get the information, to get it in a format that does not cloud or render ambiguous what's been the standard format of a report. The basic structure of what has been the audit report, and that how this information is delivered in your minds does not require or does not is not determined by any effort to enhance auditor private civil liability. In other words, you all would be happy with a solution that reaches the results of the Treasury report and the results that your survey rendered giving on the Treasury report, if it could be done in a way that did not enhance private civil liability of the audit firm. Is that fair?
Yeah, we've talked about this, and Ann may want to jump in here in a minute, because Ann and I in particular talked about this at some length. And the sense that we have is, as our subgroup, certainly, and even some of the feedback we got from the questionnaire, this is not an attempt, certainly not by the four of us, in any way to reach for auditors' wallets. This is purely an attempt to have better information, and to the extent it can be done in a way that doesn't increase their legal liability, I think we would all be supportive of that.
Has anybody ever thought about making some of this interactive? Have a day where you ask the auditor, maybe part of the annual meeting or something, where the auditor can be facing the investors and responding to questions, you know, so there could be something more direct rather than having to get some, you just do everything on paper. Is there anything, any of this ever been done? Is there a reason not to do it?
Ann Simpson, Senior Portfolio Manager, CalPERS. In my experience, auditors do attend the annual meeting.
What's that?
In my experience, auditors do come to the annual meeting. And we were, before last at the Apple annual general meeting, and the question about the reappointment of the auditors was, why didn't they use iPads? So, you know, I don't think that forum is being used to grill the auditors. My section of the system is the microphone on, I want to say how strongly we support this, even though we were just on the sidelines, how important these recommendations are. And if anyone was in any doubt, we thought it would be interesting to look at the audit report in just one of the many companies that were big recipients of TARP and systemically connected into the mortgage crisis. So we chose Bank of America. Here's the audit report from 2008, and that cost $119 million. Here's the report in 2009, word for word exactly the same, and by now the price has gone up to $193 million. This is the 2010 report, word for word exactly the same. So with that as the backdrop, I think it really gives a sense of the urgency of tackling this issue. And we very much like the idea that's circulating in Europe, and I think it was touched on by Anne, that instead of trying to do something with this particular document, we might think about the idea of an auditor's discussion and analysis, which would be a different setting and allow for narrative reporting and something which is actually useful. I should also say that during this whole period, we didn't find an auditor with less than a 95% vote in favour of their reappointment. So I suggest the whole thing at the moment is being treated as a rubber stamp, and I doubt anybody reads it, because even though it's getting more and more expensive, it's not going to give you anything you didn't have several years ago. You know, and the auditor in this case has been auditing this company for decades. So that's what we're starting. Any improvement, much appreciated.
This is Lou Ferguson. As you looked at this, did you think about the consequences, for example, if these reports are made more subjective and more analytic, what the consequences for comparability among reports would be, and among, for example, among audit firms, that whether they might use different standards that would be difficult to compare, and how does one address that? I mean, one of the few advantages of a binary report is that presumably the language is both formulaic, and it's either on or it's off, and they're comparable. But as you get to a more analytic report, obviously there's much more subjectivity in it. How do we deal with that, and how do investors deal with that for purposes of comparing reports?
Let me take a first shot, Lou. A couple of responses. One, I think the sense that we have from our respondents is that they would prefer to keep the audit report as is, binary on or off, as you said, and then supplement it with an AD&A. And that may also get to Jim's concern about legal liability. There's ways to do that may help on that front. So it would be in an AD&A. Now, you still have the same issue. The AD&A may not be comparable, right? So it just translates to a different document. There's a couple of ways to potentially deal with that. One is, presumably, if the board did move forward on this and did require an AD&A, they would put some standards around it, right? So that's a challenge from Audie and his team, but I think they could take that on. So there would be some guidance on how auditors do this, so it wouldn't just be completely free form. Secondly, you do have an inspection and an enforcement function. And so if auditors don't apply some degree of consistent standards in doing this, you get at that through inspection and enforcement. But there's also a third way, and that is the market, right? You know, Gus has a lot of smart people working at Vanguard. And that what they'll find is if these disclosures are not transparent or not good, and if over time the disclosures of things like risks and uncertainties and judgments don't map to subsequent realizations, when Vanguard casts their vote on whether KPMG or Ernst or Deloitte or whoever Grant is reappointed, maybe they won't vote for a man, and maybe it won't be 95% anymore. So more information generally makes markets work better.
One observation is, I think the biggest risk, obviously, with any request for more disclosure is that we end up with boilerplate disclosure. So I think there would be an expectation that certain companies would have different disclosures. I mean, you would hope the reports would not be the same because they're different entities, I think, with different approaches, different tones at the top. And I have to second what Joe says. If we can develop, if you can develop a format that provides meaningful non-boilerplate types of disclosures to investors, I think actually there will be pressure from the marketplace to increase the standards. It will be a great way to compare what the firms are doing. And I think ultimately it's going to be in the best interest of the marketplace at large.
Could I weigh in? I agree violently with everything that Joe and Ann just said, but I wanted to relate your responses back to Jim's question a minute ago about the perhaps in some respects overarching issue here of auditor liability. And, you know, that is a concern I hear in a lot of discussions I've had. There's a flavor of it, I think, in the survey results, but certainly in people I talk with about this issue, you always hear the concern expressed that if there are new disclosure and reporting standards imposed on auditors, it will devolve into lawyer-drafted boilerplate, much as the current auditor's report is, for that very, very concern. So there's a tension here, but I also think an opportunity to strike a balance, in which, as Ann very rightly says, that it may be appropriate to prescribe a format in which the enhanced auditor disclosure will occur, but permit it to occur in a way that it is necessary that in order to comply there be a substantive narrative discussion and disclosure of these important categories of issues in a way that invites comparison among companies and gives investors actual meaningful information, meaningful intelligence to inform their investment decision. And that I think is the key balance to be struck here and in any new rules going forward.
Why don't we recognize Barbara, Gus, Lynn, And then, Jim, if you or Mike have anything that you want to either ask or engage, the chairman's got to get out of here at 11:10. I want to save 3 minutes for myself for a question. But why don't we go in that order? And then if there's additional time, we can recognize others. Barbara.
Thanks. First of all, Joe, great presentation. Everybody, that was really terrific. So as I look at these issues, it strikes me that there ought to be two goals coming out of this. One is that you focused on extensively, which is giving investors better, more useful information. But the other is, at least as I think about it, how do we drive the behavior that we want in the audits? And I think ever since I started on the SAG, I've heard someone at every meeting, so I'll be the one at this meeting, who says, you manage what you measure. And to the degree that we require some of this information to be brought out in the open, and I would say make auditors accountable for how they present this information, you know, I think it has an opportunity, one, to help in this, you know, really huge challenge we're facing, is how do we ever get auditors to think of themselves as working for investors? This, I think, is helpful in making them sort of think about how they're communicating with investors, talking to investors, rather than just rubber stamping a management document. And if they have to report on some of these issues about risks and whatnot, maybe they'll think a little more seriously about them when they do that. And I think that would be useful in some of this helping to change the culture. But, you know, I have to say, this issue of liability drives me a little crazy, because it would be hard for me to imagine how it would be more difficult in this country at this point to sue auditors after PSLRA and after all of the court decisions that we've been through. And it is this immunity from liability that I think has contributed to a culture in which auditors don't feel like they have to be responsive to shareholders, do find a way to get comfortable with management's numbers, and don't serve their public watchdog function. So while I recognize that the threat of liability is used as an excuse to present boilerplate information, and I think that's a threat in this area, that we will end up with boilerplate, somebody needs to be prodding them from the other side and saying, look, it's not going to pass muster, and that strikes me as the responsibility of the board.
At the risk of piling on, I'd say that we recognize that what we're reading in a financial statement is an estimate, and a best estimate perhaps, and that there's subjectivity around that. But I think we would argue that more information is better than less. And even if an auditor gives us a range that isn't accurate, at least it's probably a more informed view than we can do on our own independently, because obviously they're much closer to the action than we are. Over time, as I think Joe and Ann indicated, we do think that those estimates will become better. We will have an idea, just developing our own time series, of successive estimates from a given auditor, and we'll know how to calibrate those. So I think we would certainly err on the side of more information, not less.
Steve, one brief interjection to Barbara's point. There are, of course, cases making their way along which come out of the financial crisis. We don't, for reasons that Dan discussed earlier, we don't discuss our investigations and our litigation. But we wouldn't want, taking Barbara's point, we would not want the group assembled to assume that we are simply quiescent and oblivious.
In fact, Jim, based upon conversations I've had with the defense bar, it seems like you guys are really stepping it up on the enforcement stuff, which is good to hear, knowing that that won't come out for a long time. But I do have comments along two lines. One, the legal liability issue that Barbara mentioned, which we did discuss on the ACAP report, and then some of the other issues that have been teed up in the presentation. First, on the legal liability issue, the ACAP did request from the firms and the Center for Audit Quality a fair amount of data on the cases so we could go in and look at the cases and see what the cases actually involved and whether or not these were legitimate cases or not. The firms refused to provide us that data, quite frankly, which was somewhat disturbing when you compare it to available data. If you looked at the Stanford Clearing House Cornerstone Research, NERI, on average for the last 5 years, notwithstanding the fact that that time frame encompasses when there's literally been hundreds, thousands of restatements, when there's been a subprime financial crisis, we have averaged just 6 cases being filed against the entire auditing profession on securities matters involving federal securities law, just 6 a year on average for the last 6 years. It goes to Barbara's point that with the Dura Pharmaceutical case, which upped the bar phenomenally with respect to loss causation and with respect to Talabs, it has made it almost impossible to sue the auditor today. So unless the auditor is going out and in one of these statements, expanded statements, making misstatements that they knowingly know or recklessly made, there's no risk of litigating. Now, someone may sue them, but those cases aren't even getting past the motion to dismiss these days. So despite the fact that the firms like to always take us back to the 80s and early 90s, pre-SLRA, when there was a lot of litigation, that times have changed. That's just not the case today. And legal liability, unless the firms are willing to come forward and make public what those cases are and demonstrate that they are, you know, there's a legitimate concern over some of these things, that's something that just shouldn't be done. I recall when we were doing the auditor independence rules, the firms all came in and said, if we did those rules, we'd destroy the profession. They couldn't hire anyone. Kids wouldn't want to join on. They met with Commissioner Hunt at the time. He wrote them a letter saying, well, give me the data. And the firms, again, refused to provide him the data. So they said, you can't go forward with the rulemaking without the data, but we won't give you the data. And it seems like that's what we've got. It's certainly what we saw with the ACAP committee. So I think the litigation issue is a huge red herring, and I think if you go back and read the results in the ACAP report, you'll see that there's discussion about just that in that report in light of what they couldn't get it, wouldn't give us. On some of the issues that are up here in front, I understand the SEC is going to hold hearings this summer, as was mentioned, on financial reporting and auditing, and I think that is fantastic. I think that's a very good proactive move. I think there are some serious issues out there. But I think as I look at this, it reminds me a lot of the earnings management initiative that we did. And we broke that up in between the auditing groups, the accounting standard setting group, and the piece to the SEC, and I see a lot the same. Here people are asking the auditor to say, tell us about the unusual transactions. Well, that was a recommendation in the 1978 Manny Cohen report saying the FASB ought to turn around and require disclosure of all unusual transactions. The FASB, unfortunately, never acted on that. If we'd had that, when Cohen so aptly recommended it, we wouldn't have some of these problems. But I think that is really a FASB, something in the FASB arena rather than in your arena or the auditor. And I'd say the O'Malley panel in 2000 recommended that the FASB put out something on going concern. That's 11 years ago now, coming up on 11 years ago. That, I think, O'Malley had it right. That's in the FASB arena, and they've been slow, extremely slow. Our standard setters at times are slower than a 7-year itch on acting on some of these. You know, 11 years, probably someone ought to be able to write that standard.
But Lynn, I don't want to do it to you again, but I think I have to because the chairman's going to get out of here in 10 minutes. Tony's got his card up. Brandon's got his card up. I want to give Jim an opportunity, and I'll cede my time, unfortunately, although if there is any time,
hold on for one second.
I want to get to any benefit cost analysis you've done with respect to your one or two top recommendations. So take another minute. Let's see if we can wrap up in 10 minutes. And go ahead, Lynn.
Yeah, so I'd come back and I'd say you can split some of this up. I think some goes to the FASB, some is in the purview of the PCLB, and you ought to sit down with the three of you and divvy it up who's going to do which pieces. On the risk management piece, Mary, you'll recall the big six firms at the time, big eight, I guess, came to the commission in with a very good proposal on what should be done with respect to disclosures on risk management. And I think that's worth, I think what the firms had put together was very good, and it's worth going back and revisiting that again as well, because I think they had some good ideas then that people poo-pooed, and I think in hindsight, what the firms had recommended probably people should have given more thought to.
A quick word for incrementalism. I think people should speak truthfully, and it would be helpful if we had a more robust discussion and analysis by the accountants. But if I could get there by sacrificing redoing the litigation reform debate, and if I could get there quickly rather than try and make sure that I get a fully robust discussion, I'd rather break the dam, as it were, and get that discussion and analysis and then fight another day about legal liability and the robustness of that discussion.
I just wanted to say that based on the last 11 years of being a standard setter and many more years of working with different standard setting bodies, the cost to standards of this issue of legal liability for auditors has been enormous, and it continues to weigh on us. They're always invoking it. It always affects the standards that we have, and I think it's time that we did something about that.
Jim, would you like to make any comments, or Mike?
Sure. One, I think, thanks. You've made a compelling case that when your customer says they want more, the status quo isn't acceptable. And I think the case is compelling for that. Lynn, I think, actually addressed my biggest question, was whether this is just an issue about auditing standards. In some cases, estimates or judgments. I'm really interested in if that's a cry for we're not getting what we want out of accounting standards, and if we're not getting it there, is there more to be done on the audit front? And so I think you were pretty clear that a holistic approach, if something's broken the accounting standards, let's focus there. But if there's any more on that, I'd really be interested as well.
The only thing I would add quickly to that is, and this is only a couple of anecdotes, a couple of investors told me this when I talked to them via phone, is they said, you know, the FASB has become so prolific in disclosures that some would argue there's disclosure overload. And so there's issue of the quality, but there's also the issue of the quantity. And one of the things they like about the auditor giving some opinions in these areas or additional color around these areas is that best management is biased. Even if they're honest, they're still biased because they see the world through their own lens. And the second problem is you've got to wade through that. And they felt that it would be both more objective and much more efficient. And they really emphasized the limitations on their time. If the auditors would succinctly, in an AD&A, talk about some of these things. Now, again, we didn't ask that specifically, so that's only a couple of people who told me that via phone, but that's at least one counterargument to just relying on the notes for the disclosure.
I appreciate the point on objectivity, which is a passion of mine, and I think will come up throughout the rest of the day as well, is are there things, if we're going to increase the reliance on auditors for providing additional information beyond pass-fail, what additionally do we need to do about objectivity?
Yeah, Jim, I think you raise exactly the issue, and I hope you'll take this up in the roundtables. But the bottom line is you and Joe make good points. There's data with respect to estimates that auditors probably aren't on top of it as management is. So that should be in the footnotes, and I think, yes, investors have been clamoring for more in the footnotes. With respect to estimates, you can look at FASB projects over the last three decades, and one after another, investors have clamored for that from the FASB, and the FASB doesn't give it to them. So it's no surprise we are where we are today. I personally think there is just a serious deficiency in that process. On the other hand, it is clear that investors I've talked to, while they want to get the information from management, they also want to get the investor's perspective. And the audit firms have been saying, well, let the audit committee provide that. But the audit committee, and I've served on four of these, the audit committee doesn't have the same perspective because they're not out there doing the audit. So we also want to hear from the auditor their color commentary on that data. And so what you're really looking for is a wholesome product that gives you both better disclosures and information that rightly should come from and be the responsibility and obligation, quite frankly, the liability of management, and then this color commentary from the auditor on that information. And that takes kind of a joint work of all three of you, quite frankly, to get it done right. So I think you're dead on target with what you were suggesting there.
Just answer my question, and that is with respect to the benefit cost analysis of your top two recommendations. Have you thought about it? How costly is this going to be versus how beneficial it will be?
This is obviously opinion. We don't have any data on this. But if you look at our top two recommendations, more information about the auditor's assessment of risk, Steve, and more information about the auditor's assessment of estimates and judgments. If the auditor hasn't gathered that information, it's not a gas audit. You can't do a gas audit without assessing risk. You can't do a gas audit without assessing estimates and judgments. So clearly they have the data. We're not talking about, this is not 404B revisited. Okay? This is data that exists in the work papers. So any incremental cost, and I don't want to, don't want to start the hornet's nest again, but any incremental cost would only really be reflective if firms feel that as a result of disclosing that, their liability goes up and they try to price that. Beyond that, I don't see where the incremental cost really is coming from because the data exists.
Okay, Bob, you've got the last word.
Steve, I just wanted to mention that the auditors are already providing this kind of sensitivity analysis to the audit committee by virtue of required disclosures to audit committees. I think what our group is suggesting is that gets translated in a meaningful way to investors, not just audit committees.
Good. Thank you very much. Thank you, Joe, for all the work. Thank you very much for the group. Chairman Shapiro, thank you first and foremost for spending the time. We know your busy schedule, and as I said, we really appreciate your coming. Thank you. And why don't we take a 15-minute break and get back here at, 11:30. Thank you.